This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're going to talk about in this episode include...
ups and downs at the gaming table.
Van Gibson and Derek White.
Yankee Doodle Slang.
And the Sun Language Theory.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady. Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys. And Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And as in previous gaming huts, we find ourselves not in the comfortable confines of the basement, but on the windswept battlements of Elsinore Castle. Well, they're not that windswept because we have to keep this copy of Frampton Comes Alive up somehow, because once more, we are juggling Hamlet's GM screen against ghosts and against the ghostly question, not of when will you avenge me, but what do we do with all this great stuff in Hamlet's GM screen? So now we're going to talk about that specifically. Why are we doing beat analysis in the first place? Robin?
Right. So this is the cornerstone of moment-to-moment narrative engagement, which is varying the emotional line between upbeats and downbeats. And there is not a specific singular formula. You can't go, oh, I need up, down, up, down, down, up, up, up. But you need to keep them varied. And that's what keeps people playing the game that you're running for them. It's what keeps them engaged in that game. And basically, the problem we are solving by looking at up and down beats is one of alleviating boredom, of making people excited by providing variants. So when you listen to most music, it will have variants in it, unless you're listening to drone, for example, in order to space out. And definitely in any kind of non-experimental story, you're looking to be engaged by having up and down beats. And just as you may leave a film going, oh, that was kind of all the same all the way through, I got kind of bored, you may find that your players are checking out at your table because you are not varying the line enough. And the complexity that is introduced when we start looking at a game narrative at the table, the way that we are doing in Hamlet's GM screen, it focuses on moments at the gaming table, is that all sorts of people can introduce up and down beats. Every participant can do that. They can do that in a surprising way, and sometimes in a way that is not entirely clear at the table, as we'll get into. But the clearest form of beat is the upbeat. That's why we're all engaged, especially in the sort of escapist problem-solving entertainment that we associate with trad games. And so typical upbeats in a game are, you hit the skeleton, you get healed, or you find the map, or the witness identifies a suspect, or you sneak in and out of the installation undetected, or a sympathetic player character, one that everybody else likes and wants to succeed, enters into a dramatic scene where they are petitioning their scene partner, whether it's another player character or more often in a trad game, a game master character, or in Hill Folk, usually a player character. If the sympathetic player character gets what they want in a dramatic scene, that's an upbeat, and that's the same for everybody else at the table as any other vicarious drama. When someone we like gets what they want, we like that too. We share that with them. And if most of the players at the table are rooting for that player to get what they want dramatically, not only that player, but everyone else around the players forming the audience for that scene also feel that upbeat. Ken, is this not the simplest concept in storytelling?
Yeah, I mean, just like, you know, salt and sugar are the simplest parts of food, but you can't make a food entirely out of it, unless, I guess, you're the good people at Mars Bars. So with every upbeat, there comes a downbeat, or possibly several downbeats if it's a horror game. And those, I guess, are basically the opposite of the previous upbeats, in that for every time you hit a skeleton, you get bonked on the head by a different skeleton, right?
Right. There's two kinds of downbeats you can have when you're fighting a skeleton. You can miss the skeleton, and the skeleton can hit you. So there's twice the capacity for things to go wrong. And that is why fights feel tense, right? Is that you feel a greater sense of disappointment, a downbeat, when you roll the dice and you fail to hit, than when the GM rolls the dice and the skeleton fails to hit, right? That, even if the GM, you know, tries to play that up, you know, the skeleton rears back with his mighty great axe and he swings towards you and you duck. You know, that might work once or twice, but it's not going to work every single time. It doesn't have the same impact. Whereas the game part of a fight, you're very much aware that the opportunities to act are resources. You've just lost a resource by missing. And that's a bummer. And I guess, especially if you have some sort of spell that only works for one attempted hit, that's an even bigger downbeat.
Yeah, if you used your only once per scene or your only once per session power and it whiffs.
Yes, exactly. A whiff is a big problem in a fight. So most revelations are good, but what if you find out that the jewel you stole turns out to be fake? That can be a big downbeat, depending on how much time you spent in trying to get it, how much resources the team expended trying to get that jewel, and then you're going to shake your fist and want to find out who faked that jewel and go after them, which could be an anticipation beat if we remember how those worked from last week. When you're engaged in an investigation and everybody's very invested in a particular suspect being the one who did it, and then you find out, oh, he's got a solid alibi, he can't have done it, that's a downbeat, because not only does it mean that the character that you are rooting for to be the bad guy isn't, and so you can't take whatever righteous revenge on them you wanted to, or you can't serve them up a steaming plate of justice. You know, if you do something, it'll have to be sneaky and not approved by the authorities. But then that means you've got to start over again, finding out who did it. So that's a downbeat. Just as sneaking into the installation undetected is an upbeat, the opposite of that, sneaking out of the installation and getting caught, is a downbeat. And then finally, when we come to the dramatic scene, if the PC we care about is seeking something emotionally from somebody else, is making a dramatic petition, and they're rebuffed, they get shut down, they don't get what they want, that player and everyone else at the table probably all feel a downbeat as well.
And so, and I guess the important thing to keep in mind with downbeats is that they don't lower tension necessarily, right? They're not down in the sense of dull or relaxing or slow and melancholy beats. They're beats that the wished for direction of the story changes in the other direction. And for example, you get caught sneaking out of the installation. That becomes a tense moment. It gets everyone elevated. Their adrenaline goes up because now there are guards. Now the dogs are coming, whatever it is, that creates more tension and excitement than necessarily even the upbeat of, and you get away. That's a happy beat. Everyone has a moment, but it doesn't create tension. So the downbeat is not the relaxation beat or the dull beat. It is directional, not emotional. Is
right. That? And the direction is toward fear. So when the arrow points down, it points toward the things that you are fearing possibly happening. And when the arrow points up, it points up toward the thing we hope will happen. And in fact, the thing that relieves tension in a game is often the upbeat, because you can relax a bit. Things are great. You can hang out on the beach. The monster didn't come at you. And so in general, downbeats increase tension and upbeats relieve it. The game becomes, goes toward melancholy or toward dullness when you have too many downbeats in a row and the prospect of an upbeat is not surfacing. From these two beats, the upbeat and the downbeat, we sometimes come to crossed beats, moments of ambiguity, which can be the strongest moments of a narrative because they're pulling us as audience members and at the gaming table as participants in two different directions. So there is the thing where you've achieved something, you learn that somebody is, for example, the culprit, but then you find out, oh no, this, I didn't want this person to be the culprit, either because you sympathize with them too much or because they're not to be messed with. You could argue that that's two beats in a row, not a cross beat, but sometimes the information and the emotional reaction happen at the same time. And so that's an ambiguous beat.
And that's the same thing with, you know, the two beats in a row, or is it a cross beat? Well, that is about the rhythm of play. You know, you've found the gem, you grab the gem, upbeat, but that triggers the alarm, or that, you know, awakens the demon, downbeat, but they happen at just the same time. You see the gem, I grab the gem, demon emerges. That's a crossbeat in terms of how you experience it in a single breath at the table, even though any crossbeat, I guess, can be shaved ever so thin into micro up and micro down. Am I right?
Well, some are just, you can't unshave them. So for example, if the players are proposing plans of action and there's more than one suggestion at the table and people are, you know, fervently arguing for one over the other, that's happening in the moment. And the players are currently now at a crossed angle with each other. And so that leads to a crossed beat because that introduces the ambiguity of the unity the group is in order and different people are rooting for different things. So that's a classic ambiguous beat that is intrinsic to gaming, to tabletop gaming, but not to the other narrative things that past beat analysis books have looked at. And then there's the doubled emotion of something bad happening to your character that you love playing out. Classically, you know, failing a sanity roll in Call of Cthulhu, or the stability or composure equivalent in Gumshoe. So you're enjoying the terrible thing that's happening to you in a horror game, which is the whole point of the horror game, but you're both experiencing horror as the character and creative fulfillment as the player. So that's an absolutely classic ambiguous crossed beat. And unlike a lot of other cross beats, that's exactly what you've come there for. The ambiguity is the fun of it. You also, however, can get a situation, as I alluded to previously, where there's a dramatic scene and it's not clear at the table that everybody is rooting for the player character to get what they want, that some people think that Zendara should absolutely get the approval of her mother. Other people are thinking, Zendara's kind of being a pill and she's going to be insufferable if she gets the approval of her mother. And so the character in a dramatic beat can get what they want, and there can be mixed feelings about that at the table. So you could think of that as each individual person's up or down beat going one way or the other. But in terms of the gestalt of the table that you as the GM are going to have to react to, it definitely plays as an ambiguous beat.
Yes, in my current game, that's the Loredan marriage beat. Is congratulations, the most powerful and rich house in Venice has decided to marry you. Okay, I'm happy, but also...
That's very historically accurate ambiguity.
Yep, that's how we do it.
Also, as players can introduce things, not just as characters, but as themselves that have an emotional resonance at the table, someone at the table may say something that's somewhat ambiguous that lands as a crossbeat. So for example, player B may be asking the GM to let them do something, perhaps bend a rule a little or interpret a crunchy bit in their favor. And then player A says about player B, well, yeah, sure, let them have it, or they'll be really annoying about it. So that's both approval and disapproval wrapped into one. The ambiguity of actual human interaction can land as a crossbeat as well.
And now that we've done up, down, and across, I guess the only thing we have is back to your drone, back to the steady hum, back to the neutral beat, right?
Right. And you can guess I guess if we want to talk about it non-judgmentally, we could call it a lateral resolution. But since I do want to talk about it judgmentally, it's a neutral or even flat resolution. And the thing about these moments is they are the moments that kind of go nowhere. And it's fine to have the occasional flat moment. You can't have every single moment have a clear emotional valence one way or the other. But too many of them in a row, and that's when your players start to disengage, and you need to A, notice that, and B, figure out how to get them back on board. So examples of kind of neutral beats are just the administrative beats of being a GM, where you say, okay, everybody check the Google Doc for that. Well, that's completely flat, but also something that no one expects to have an emotional quality to it. But if you spend 10 minutes describing how the Google Doc works, you're losing people with all of these lateral or neutral resolutions. Or just the GM making a request at the top of a scene. Hey, everybody, describe what your characters are doing. That has no emotional weight to it. Arguably, maybe it creates a little bit of anticipation because it's a cue for people to get to exercise their creativity. But that's not the moment that anybody's going to react emotionally to. Other flat moments are, a player can makes a joke and then just gets dead silence. You get crickets. That's very lateral, very neutral. If the player then goes to rescue the joke by amusingly complaining about how it failed, that becomes an upbeat. If they get miffed, that becomes a downbeat. If they try it again and it still fails, that's another lateral beat. You maybe want to cut them off and move on to something else. One thing to really look out for, though, is when you've had so many beats in a row that something that would normally be an up or down beat just becomes a flat beat through repetition. So for example, when you're reading out box text and it's gone on for a little while and what you're saying is not, the person who's written the box text has maybe not thought about the attention spans of players and it goes past the point of anyone caring, people are starting to tune out. Every little bit of added description you add after people are tuning out is another flat or lateral beat. Not all neutral beats are bad. For example, we talked about the pipe beat last week, which is you're sneaking in a little bit of information that'll matter later. In that one, you don't want anyone to notice, either to get worried or hopeful about it. And so if you get that in there, it should usually be a neutral beat, and that's perfectly fine. And so the issue arises when you've got too many of one kind of beat in a row, and too many for a neutral beat is much sooner than too many up or too many down beats. And also the ambiguous beats, they can be the most compelling beats, but you really got to watch having too many of them in a row, because if you've got a whole bunch of moments where there's no unity of understanding or caring at the table, or it's not clear what's going on, or just everybody's emotions are too complex, the power of that drains really quickly and turns into sort of a narrative confusion where it's like we've lost track of what we're supposed to care about. We can't care about opposite things at once too many times before we need some sort of release. So thank goodness skeletons are coming to attack us. And when skeletons come to attack us, we get out of the segment. Next week, we'll have a little break from the Hamlet's GM screen, but we'll be back with more from that a little later on down the road. And Ken, let's all greet with excitement and anticipation this commercial, which will surely end on an up note.
It's a real upbeat. In a hole in the ground, they found a body.
I know! Here we are in Maryshire, right in the middle of the beautiful bucolic riding.
So bucolic.
With its neat hedgerows, and picturesque taverns, and delightful crumpet shops, and quaint little village greens.
Can we go back to the crumpets?
Yes, so what did you want to know about them?
I wanted to have some crumpets and shut off the recording.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, we're back. What were we saying?
Murder!
Murder?
Yes, we've got murder to solve.
In the bucolic riding? Where all the halflings live?
Yes, the halflings. Plus also some boggarts, pukas, and dwarves. But weren't we concerned about something?
Murder?
Yes, murder! Another case in need of sleuthing by a team of amateur detectives.
It would be unthinkable if this wasn't the third murder this week.
Maryshire Detective Club is a fantasy mystery-solving RPG.
By the master of fantasy and mystery.
And fantasy mystery.
Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
Investigate crimes, question eccentric neighbors, stop for tea and cakes, unravel puzzles, and get involved in pedantic arguments about jam.
Wait, what kind of jam?
In the most adorable...
but still murdery...
gumshoe game yet, you gather clues, uncover motives, follow gossip, question suspicious neighbors, stop for lunch, get sidetracked. Remember, you're supposed to be solving a case. Gather some more clues. Question more eccentric locals.
Possibly chase a swan or something.
And slowly piece together the truth.
Coming soon to Backer Kit from Pelgrane Press.
Type Backer Kit and Marisher into your favorite search engine to find the launch page.
It's time once again for Ken and or Robin talk to someone else. And today I, Ken, am at sunny San Marcos, Texas, at sunny ChupacabraCon, talking not to one someone else, but two someone else's, Than Gibson and Derek White, the creators of Dark Space. And we'll get into all that in a bit. But first, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on. Good to see you guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for allowing us to be here.
Tell me, how did you guys fall to the dark side of the dark space and become game designers instead of productive members of society? Is there some sort of witness protection situation going on? Help us out.
Some of the work I was doing made me want to find some quick, fast, easy sci-fi rules. And so I was playtesting all types of different systems, but I realized I wanted one that was fast, quick, and easy to play that had risk to it. So that it would allow for tension in gameplay. And I began talking to Than. We'd been friends for a few years already. We'd gotten to know each other really well. And I said, Than, we need something that's fast, quick, and easy that people are familiar with. And Than said, you know what? We could try and base this off of Shadow Dark. And that was pretty much the beginning of the project. Because I, as my work as a chaplain and things like that, I set up things at churches and various other organizations. And I wanted some sci-fi because I've been playing fantasy since the early 1980s.
Right.
And that was the impetus of it.
And this is your both of your first design, your first stuff in the field?
Yeah, for the most part. I've been, you know, a GM for most of my life.
Right. Yeah.
So I've done a lot of like, you know, amateur stuff. I've done, I did do like a small, like Dragonlance third party for Drive-Thru RPG or DM's Guild at one point. That was the first thing I published. I had a blog, had a comic. I'd done a few things like that, but this was the first big thing that I had done, game design.
And so this is for both of you, your first major step.
Yeah.
And it's taking a legendarily difficult genre to do well in gaming and then attaching it to what one might think is an unpromising engine, because D20 writ large doesn't really mesh well with science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
What about Shadow Dark, besides the speed of play and the risk that you mentioned, is the thing that you said, oh, this needs to be the engine for science fiction?
Yeah. So, you know, getting back to the, you know, kind of core tenets that Derek mentioned there, we very quickly kind of came up with an ethos that was, you know, simple yet elegant. And Shadow Dark does provide that. The action economy is very tight. One action, one move. You take your turn, you go on, next person. So everything moves very quickly. Things like the torch timer that allow the table to keep moving. There's not a lot of analysis paralysis because of something like that. You can work with that mechanic and use it in a lot of different ways. And so that really, you know, was some of the reasons why behind this. And also, D20 is historically maybe not the best for sci-fi, but at the same time, D20 is the one that most people know.
Right.
It's very accessible. Yeah. And Shadow Dark being a stripped down version of it makes it even more accessible.
Yeah, and for those of you out there who may not know Shadow Dark, first of all, how dare you? But second of all, I've described it as sort of taking my memories of playing D&D and making a game that just does that.
Yep.
As opposed to a game that is attempting to either rebuild the fantasy battle or something else. That it is very much the shiny part of the iceberg.
Yes.
From F20, and then that's all the game at play. And why don't you remind our listening audience what the torch timer is in Shadow Dark, and then how do you turn that into a science fiction world in which, in theory, we have batteries and atomic piles and
right.
power shortages are not necessarily yeah. as core to the experience.
Yeah. So, yeah, Shadow Dark has this kind of innovative little mechanic called the torch timer where, there's no dark vision. It strips the dark vision out of fifth edition, which is nice. So, if you're in the dark as a player, all of your actions are at disadvantage. The monsters can see in the dark, so they're not at disadvantage.
Right.
And so the timer, the way that you track your light resource is a 1 hour real-time timer.
Right. Like a kitchen timer.
Kitchen timer, or use your phone, or, you know, something like that. Right. And so it builds a sense of urgency. It keeps the game moving. People can't sit around in the dungeon and map it out every 5 feet because your torches are going to run out.
Right.
And so the way that we've worked that into Dark Space with a sci-fi setting is we've kind of turned that into the survival timer instead. So anything that requires you to survive, that's when you can put the timer on. So it could be, we have energy cells. So that's how you fuel your energy weapons, but it's also how you might, you know, fuel your glow rod. So it's a, you know, it's a 1 hour battery. There's a little fiat there, but most people accept it.
Or it might be your oxygen.
It could be your oxygen.
We've done that a lot.
Yeah. Our rebreathers do have an energy cell that runs it. So it has the 1 hour.
The term I've been using a lot lately is a tension timer.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
And so one of the things we do is the spaceship's going down. You have 1 hour to figure out how to keep it from sinking into the gravity well of this planet.
Yeah.
So you've got an hour of real time to figure out how to get the systems back online, mm-hmm. do this. So there's a variety of ways that you can use a timer within your game to keep it moving
fast. So it's almost like taking that core mechanic that Kelsey came up with for Shadow Dark.
Yeah.
And instead of applying it to one thing, you say, what kinds of scenarios fit
yes.
this mechanic?
Yeah.
Tell me about briefly your relationship with Kelsey Dionne, the designer of
Shadow Dark.
Good Lord. yeah. And was it a beneficial? Did she say good luck, boys, and et cetera? Yeah, or what?
Yeah.
Tell me about the back and forth in terms of attaching your idea
yeah.
to what, you know, is at least currently one of the very highest energy parts sure. of the larger F-20 tree.
Right. So Kelsey and I met in 2019. I had interviewed her for a blog that I was writing for at the time, and we kind of stayed in touch through the development of Shadow Dark a little bit. So we have a bit of history, you know, just from a, you know, kind of professional and seeing each other at cons and things like that. Derek, you also kind of met her through GaryCon as well.
I'm the chaplain for GaryCon, and the quick Kelsey story I have, she knew me before I knew her.
Right.
I do the memorial wall at GaryCon, and she had written on there before she developed Shadow Dart, thank you, Gary, for telling me when I was a kid I could become a GM.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how I knew Kelsey, and Kelsey knew me, and he met Kelsey the same year we met.
Yeah.
Right.
Which was kind of cool. So it was this synchronicity that just flowed together.
Yeah. So then so we had that kind of background there that when we had, you know, sort of the first copy of the rules, Derek just happened to be at Page, yeah. Philadelphia Area Gaming Expo, and Kelsey was there as well. And you were playtesting.
Well, actually, before that.
Yeah.
When I was at Origins and we were still working on it.
Okay.
She came up to my booth at Origins. I have a Geek Preacher booth at Origins, and she came up there just being friendly, saying hello. And I said, Kelsey, can I show you this that Fan and I are working on?
Yeah.
And she was just ecstatic and said, you go for it.
Yeah.
Right.
Fan is amazing. She loves Fan. Fan has a really great grasp of rules. And so Fan got back. He's really great at layout and putting all that together. So we were working on it, sending messages back and forth. And then at Page, by the time Page came around in 2025, mm-hmm. I was asked to be a guest there, and we had our first book, and I got to show it to Kelsey.
Right.
And Kelsey was just so encouraging.
Yeah.
Go for it. I'm so excited for you guys.
Yeah.
And she is just such a light to this hobby. She truly believes that a rising tide lifts all boats. We all say this,
mm-hmm.
but she believes it and lives into it. And
she walks the walk.
She does. Yeah. She does.
Yeah.
So you've got the core book.
Yes.
What else is there for Dark Space? What's coming up for Dark Space? How big of an ecosystem are you going to build? Or yeah. is it going to be dark space starships, dark space robots, dark space cyberpunk, dark. I mean, what's the what's the approach? I mean, moving from game design to line design,
right?
I guess.
Yeah. So we've got a few things already. Now that the big book, we did a small core book that's still available. That's about 84 pages, streamlined rules, and then the big book has a GM section and extra things in that. That's going to be our primary rule book. So now that that's out, we have a zine line, like an official zine that we do every year called Void Echoes. Second issue of it just came out. We were finishing fulfillment on that. That was done as part of Zine Quest. That always has some new rules in it, pre-gen characters, and an adventure.
Right.
So that's a good way. It's sort of like our little homage to like a Dragon magazine or something like that. Then we have a ship catalog. So we are doing a little bit of like the dark space ships where it's just a small, thin book that has, you know, 20, 24, however many ships I can fit into a book, a little zine-sized book. The first volume of that came out last year. The second one of that's going to come out this year. And then we've done one setting book that was in conjunction with Menagerie Press called Xeno Salvage. And that is just a quick, again, it's like, 48 pages.
48, yeah.
That was, you know, what happens with an alien invasion after you've repelled the aliens? So
right.
Independence Day happened. They got rid of the aliens, but Earth's all messed up. Now what do we do?
And someone's got to recover all the crashed spaceships.
Exactly.
That's right. Exactly.
That's
right.
Yeah.
And so, not to necessarily turn this into dollars and cents, but do you sense that the market, or at least your part of the market, is responding to that sort of small, fast release model as opposed to a book a year or something like that?
Yeah.
Oh, heck
definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I mean, people are asking us, when's the next thing coming out? And the key is that
I ask you that when there's a big book coming out.
Sure.
It's just a less happy answer.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, the lanes that we're in, the third party license for Shadow Dark. So the, you know, the Shadow Dark ecosystem of all third party creators, we all kind of work in that space.
Right.
So a lot of the, you know, the gamers, the customers, for lack of a better word, are used to that.
Right.
They like to see the little small things come out every quarter or something like that. If you do a big thing every once in a while, that's awesome. And they'll support you with that. But I don't think you have to build up to the one big.
So you're not on the supplement treadmill in the way that we all were in the 90s.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And that some people still are.
Yeah.
So is deeper and darker for dark space the thing, or do you guys have your eyes on another possibility?
It's still going very strong right now. So we'll be keeping and building on dark space for a while. We have our own kind of subset of the third party license.
Right.
So Shadow Dark has it. So we have our own kind of fork of it. We have people that are writing for it as well. We call it our third party fleet.
Right.
And so that continues to build. And so the more third party creators we have building us up, then the more we're going to continue to support this as well. So we'll stay with dark space for a while. We're still on an upward trajectory with it right now.
And that's one of the things that I've noted from maybe a little far outside the scene. But one of the things I've noticed about that Shadow Dark universe is that it's very, very open to other creators, very
definitely.
Come on in, do your zine, do your PDF, do your whatever, in a way that maybe other F20 games are not as welcoming.
I liken it to like the punk scene or the jazz scene where everybody's just kind of building off of each other. It's all just everybody kind of like you said, all, you know, all rising tide lifts all ships. We're all in it together. We're all there to support each other. We're all there to lift each other up.
Right.
Yeah. The big thing I'm seeing in the hobby that really makes me happy because of where I come from is that people are really playing the games. Because I remember you were talking about the 90s and the 2000s, and all these books were coming out and I was buying them because it's like, oh, this is the new cool thing. And they still sit on my shelves to this day, 20 years later, with dust on them, and I never crack them open to play them.
Right.
And that's one of the things I'm loving about Shadow Dark, and I'm loving about Dark Space, is people are playing these games. And that's what really gets us excited when somebody sends us a message, hey, I just ran this adventure you guys wrote, or I just wrote my own adventure. I mean, early on, we tripped out. Because this guy sent us a message. The game had only been out maybe 3 or 4 months. Mm-hmm. Sent us a message and was using Dark Space to run a Spaceballs game.
Okay.
At a convention
that we didn't go to.
That we didn't go to or even know about. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And that is where we derive a lot of our enjoyment for what we're doing.
Yeah. So that's terrific. Where can people find Dark Space on the net or wherever?
Yeah. So
you have to say net when you're talking about science fiction.
Sure.
You can't just say web.
Right. So Dark Space RPG, that most of the socials, you can find it at Dark Space RPG. Our website is DMingTheWorld.com. DMing the World Press is our press label.
Right.
Our
print label. Hyphens are
none it's of all that. One word.
All one word.
All one word.
DMing the World.
DMingTheWorld.com.
Yeah. All right. So look there for all your Dark Space needs, or go on, I assume, DriveThru or Itch and type in Dark Space and you'll get what you want. All one word. In my mind, as both a designer and a player, one of the most exciting and interesting and fun parts of the modern day design scene is, rather than trying to reinvent Holmes and Moltke, saying, let's reinvent playing Holmes and Moltke. Mm-hmm. Let's see what that we can do with that. Mm-hmm. And you guys, being part of that, I don't want to say reinventing Mark Miller, but maybe reinventing playing Traveler Wrong, which I think we all did a great deal in the 70s. So welcome to my childhood, and thanks very much for contributing, and thanks for being on the show as
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com.
Protect this podcast from a fatal series of downbeats by joining beloved Patreon backers.
Paul and Cleo Bushland.
Michael Kuehl.
Ian Carlson.
James Stewart.
And Michael Hawkins. When you're listening to this podcast, you're listening to us say words. And as writers, we write with words all the time. You could say they're the basic building blocks of what we're doing. And this time around, we're combining our love of words with our love of history and our love of our beloved sponsors, Nations and Canons, who have their Kickstarter coming up for The American Crisis, The Dark and Bloody Ground. And so that put me in mind, Ken, of one of my fiendishly difficult quizzes that I will put you through.
Love
There's a reason why no one lets me write pub quizzes anymore. And so in this quiz, Ken, I'm going to give you slang terms. And the question that you are going to attempt to answer is whether this slang term first arose during the Revolutionary War period, whether Nations and Canons characters would be within historical bounds to use that term, or if that term came up somewhat later.
Oh.
So we're not going to use the obvious terms like black tar that would give it away, or, you know, things related to, you know, musketry or what have you. But these are just slang terms, most of which we still use today, but they came into usage either during or just after the Revolutionary War or sometime later.
So would George Washington have said 23 skidoo? The question
exactly
that has torn linguists and historians apart for centuries.
This is what everyone wants to know.
Right.
I said already, this is fiendishly difficult. So can you win if you beat random chance. So if you get 11 out of these 20, you win. But if you get radically lower than random chance, it means you have psychic powers, which is a different hunt altogether.
Fantastic.
Yes. And the listeners win, of course, playing along at home if they get more than you, whatever that turns out to be.
Right.
And I'd be interested to hear what Pat and Tristan of Flag Bearer Games do when they play this. So the first of the 20 words is biddy, as in an old lady, a disparaging term for an old lady.
A biddy has to be, I say yes, John Adams called people biddies.
You are correct. You score a point.
Yay.
Bogus.
Bogus. Man, it would be amazing if like Alexander Hamilton and James Madison are calling people bogus at the Battle of Trenton. But you know what? I'm going to root for it to be true, but my head says it's not true, but my heart wants it to be true. So I'm going to say no, bogus is post-revolution.
It is post-revolution, but it is still earlier than you would think. It's much earlier than Bill and Ted times. It's early 19th century.
All right. So Hamilton and Madison could still have said it. Oh, I guess Hamilton couldn't because he was shot, but Madison could still have said it.
Yes. Yes. People who far outlived revolutionary times could have said some of these things. The next one, bug, as in an obsessive interest, as in I've got the powdered wig bug.
I think bug is contemporary. Yes. I think that Franklin would say that he has the lightning bug, and then he would just laugh and laugh and laugh, and then they'd wait for it to be translated into French.
That is a little later.
Oh, boo.
Next, we come to card, as in wiseacre or smartass. That guy's a real card. Would you have said that at the Battle of Valley Forge?
I think that they were too cold to be calling people cards at Valley Forge. I think card comes around later.
You are correct. Would you be thrown in the clink if you committed a crime during the Revolutionary War?
You absolutely would. The clink is named after an Elizabethan prison, so you'd better be able to be thrown into the clink if you, like Benedict Arnold, are a hateful traitor.
There you go. Well, you're well on your way to getting 11 or more. Chatterbox. If someone was talking a bit too much in the battle formation and you're worried about being overheard, would you call them a chatterbox?
Would Nathaniel Green call someone out for being a chatterbox? I feel like he might. I feel like I've read that in Jane Austen, and I don't think she invented it. I may be confabulating here, but that's my thought.
You are correct. You're well on your way. You're making it very difficult for other people to win at home.
That's how the revolution works.
Right. If you were annoyed at someone else at the Continental Crisis, would you call them a chowderhead?
A chowderhead. Oh, man. Again, an army that's half Massachusetts, someone has to have been called a chowderhead. But I feel like maybe that's a little late. Maybe chowderhead is late.
You were correct again.
Oh,
this quiz is not nearly as fiendishly difficult as I had planned.
I'm killing it.
Yeah.
It's because it's so close to July, Robin, and my American powers crescendo there.
Yeah. So if someone is singing, are they crooning in the Revolutionary War? Are there crooners?
Are there crooners? Greatest threat in the history of forums. Again, this is one I'm not going to be surprised if I'm wrong, but I'm going to say it's post-1800.
It is actually a Revolutionary War term. Bing Crosby apparently got in his time machine and did some crooning.
Exactly.
Some slang terms are so useful that they stop being slang terms and just become regular words. But what about the word dime for a 10-cent piece?
Oh, a dime. Let me see. You know what? That could go either way, frankly. I'm going to say that it is Revolutionary War, though.
That is correct. I think people pretty quickly, once there is new money, stop saying 10-cent piece. That's way too many syllables for a dime.
Right. Dime is money, don't you know?
Yep. If a cannon goes off in a way that you find disconcerting, do you say golly?
Golly. Yeah, that sounds very Americanism-y. I think that's what Agatha Christie has all of her American characters say, golly, all the time. But do we say it before America?
Golly has only recently died out, non-ironically.
I think golly is... Yeah, I'm going to say golly is revolutionary.
You are correct. You're killing it, Ken. So if you're accused of a crime and you can explain that you weren't anywhere near it, in the Revolutionary War era, is your alibi ironclad? So this is the term ironclad in the sense of unimpeachable.
Oh, man. Yeah, very little is ironclad in the Revolutionary era. Not even cannons necessarily are ironclad. Ironclads aren't even ironclad. I'm going to say ironclad is post. More things have to be clad with iron before you can have an alibi likewise.
That is correct. However, can your nation's and cannons character sneak up and whack somebody on the noggin?
On the noggin. Oh, the noggin.
God bless the Noggin. This, again, is one that I will not be surprised to be wrong about, but I think Noggin is post-revolutionary.
It is revolutionary. You could absolutely whack somebody in the Noggin. Can you use your musket to plug somebody? So as in plug, as in shoot.
Plug as in shoot. Boy, that's all over. I, again, wouldn't be surprised, but I'm going to stick with post-revolutionary as my theory.
It is post. Now we come to raft as in a large number. So there's a raft of Hessians coming our way. Is that something that was ever spoken?
Ever by anyone? Yes. A raft?
And literal rafts don't count for the purpose of
right,
the question.
Right, yeah. Literal rafts. Obviously, they had rafts. That's how they got across the Delaware. Well, actually, they got across the Delaware.
But were they large
in
numbers?
In coal boats, but they got across in small numbers. Is a raft a large number of people? This is just about keelboat times. I would say that a raft being a large number is post.
That is correct. Mm. So scene as in to cause an uproar, to create a scandal. You've made a scene, Martha Washington. Is that a thing?
I think making a scene is revolutionary or even maybe earlier, I feel like.
It came into use or is first found anyway in the written record in the Revolutionary era.
Excellent.
And here's one that's always kind of odd. I think this lasted as long as like our grandparents' generation, but it's sort of an opposite of thing. Shaver, meaning kid. You would think someone who's a shaver is not a kid, but shavers were kids for a long time. Did that start in the Revolutionary War era?
A shaver. I feel like a shaver is, this is another one of those that it's so antique American, as you say, that you wouldn't be surprised to find someone describing Aaron Burr as a shaver. But I feel like, you know what? I'm going to say pre-revolutionary or revolutionary.
Your last minute shift there paid off. That is indeed something that you can say in Nations and Canons.
Fantastic.
But can you say that Benedict Arnold is shifty, as in untrustworthy?
Ooh, well, I can certainly say it, but can I say it in period?
You're not in period. You're totally right. Anachronistic.
That's the whole point of having a time machine. Is Benedict Arnold shifty in 1779 and 1780 when he is plotting to betray America? I will say yes, he is shifty.
So, no, in fact, that is later. You'd have to come up with some other insult for Benedict Arnold.
A challenge worthy of my steel.
Yes. Next, we come to another large number, slew. As in a slew of Hessians. Are they coming at us?
A slew. Oh, my God. I'm going to say a slew is post.
That is correct. If you fool someone into doing what you want, not what they want, are they a sucker? As in one who's born every minute?
Oh, man, the sucker. What we wouldn't give for Dan Morgan to shout, "I'm going to get you, sucker," at Cornwallis. But I feel like it's definitely New England. It's definitely American. I'm going to say it's post-revolutionary, though.
It is post-revolutionary. And finally, if you help yourself to some treasure that you find on the aforementioned Hessians, have you acquired some swag? Are you one of the first people to use swag for loot?
I think swag is revolutionary era. I'm going to say yes.
That is correct. And so, Ken, you only got 5 of these wrong. So you got far better than 11. You got 15.
Better than my normal quiz by far.
Yeah, this is surprisingly easy. So Listeners at home, you can tell us if you found it surprisingly easy and if you got 16 or more and beat Ken. And now that we all know what to say and what not to say when someone in a tricorn hat points a musket at us, it's time for us to flee to the next hut and or segment.
The British are coming.
The Kickstarter campaign is almost upon us for Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Canons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Canons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
The Kickstarter campaign also features a revised core book supporting play in other eras, a supplement about political scheming within the two sides of the war, and years of maps, supplements, splat books, and adventures following the war from Boston to Yorktown.
Nations and Canons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
This Kickstarter is the best time ever to get into Nations and Canons.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. Now it is time to enter that most curious hut, the one where we're not really sure what's going on. There's aliens over in the corner. They're drinking kombucha. And since I'm mentioning them first, they are looking disconcerted because they know this means it can't possibly be one of their segments. And we're going to look out the window, see the alien big cat screaming on the moor. And what he's screaming is, it's been a long time since the Elepteny Hut has looked at a crank theory. So we're going to do that today with the sun language theory of Hermann Feodor Kvergich. And this is a delightful story of linguistics and government work. And so, Ken, why don't we begin with who was Hermann Feodor Kvergich?
Well, we don't know an awful lot about Hermann Feodor, as though he were some sort of weird crank that real historians of language would like to forget. But we do know that he was born in 1895 in Bratislava, so up in what is now Slovakia. He is of Yugoslavian extraction, a word that he would never have used, but I don't know if he was a Slovene or a Croat at the time, so I just have to say Yugoslavian, because that's what it says on his University of Vienna papers. In 1914, he graduates from high school in Graz, Austria. One assumes he then serves in World War I, but there's no information that I could find about that. He survives the war, goes back to school at the University of Vienna and also the University of Graz, winds up studying medicine and psychology and what they called at the time Oriental Studies, which meant the studies mostly of the languages, but also the folkways of the Near East. So Oriental Studies was everything basically, you know, east of Athens was Oriental Studies. So he gets his doctorate in 1927. And it is around this time that his wife Gertrude befriends Sigmund Freud. And we know that from Sigmund Freud's two surviving letters to or about Gertrude Kvergich Krauss, as she was at the time. So Freud and at least his wife were buddies. And since he is very interested in psychology as a core of linguistics, one can assume that he at least would tag along and be a third wheel on their discussions, and that perhaps he and Freud were buddies, but Freud didn't need to write him any letters. So there we are. In 1929, he begins traveling around Asia. We know he's in Afghanistan and Iran. By 1933, he's gotten back around to Turkey. And Turkey at this time is in a linguistic ferment, to say the least. The Turkish Language Commission is set up because Ataturk, who by now is dictator of Turkey, wants to change Turkey from a backward country to a modern European country. And that means getting rid of the old Arabic alphabet and going to a Roman alphabet. And now comes the knotty question of how do you spell all the words? And do we use new words or do we use good Turkish words? And if we're using good Turkish words, how do we find that out? And Robin, you've uncovered right. A sort of a Turkish WPA.
And what is Turkish?
Right.
Is his question. He's reforming not only Turkey, but Turkish, because there is a language called Ottoman Turkish, but he's putting that in the dustbin along with the other remnants of that empire. And so he wants to find a new modern language. But the problem is that the vocabulary of spoken Turkish is full of Arabic and Persian loan words. And that aggression cannot stand. So he sets up the Turkish Language Commission, hires a bunch of linguists. He himself is an enthusiast of languages. He's a bit of a linguist himself, he might tell you. Mm-hmm. And so he sends out word through the TDK to give bureaucrats, teachers, army officers, doctors, all throughout the country, a second job, which is to gather typical regional words. They're searching for Turkish versions of all of these words that have Arabic or Persian roots so they can replace them. And so this all sounds great. And in fact, Turkey is a surprising example. The language undergoes rapid evolution a couple of times in a top-down manner, and it's surprisingly successful. But this time around, there's a bit of a hitch because all of these words gathered from all of these, what would be essentially regional dialects, are all dumped into a single document called the Tamara Dirghizi. And this is the intention of this document. It's just as a starting point. It's just to go, well, look at all of our different choices for synonyms for words that we want to replace. And instead, what it becomes, under the powers of all of the word nerds that have been hired for the TDK, it then just becomes treated as a fully reliable standard reference text, and that all of the words in those are deemed valid. And that sounds very cool as well. So all these words, they can all run and play together. That's great. Except it means that suddenly, if you're trying to replace an Arabic-derived or Persian-derived word, you can pick from anywhere, like from a dozen different choices. And chaos reigns. So they do a hash job of the new Turkish, which is called Ozturk. And Ataturk himself, this was his idea. Ataturk, as I believe he believed, never wrong, except this thing he commanded to exist, he hated it. He really didn't like Ozturk, especially after he got up to speak at a banquet where there's a Swiss delegation gathered. And so also there are poor translators having to translate this new weird language that the TDK had come up with. So they were in even more of a pickle. But even Ataturk could tell that his speech was bombing. He could hear himself speak this horrible text that nobody understood, and it sounded like gibberish, and even worse than not being understood, because frequently it's the goal of a politician to not really be understood. But he sounded awkward. He sounded like a fool speaking in this language. And so, Ken, this is where Kvirgic comes in.
Yeah. Again, Ataturk used to be in the military. He's probably by now well used to giving intelligent orders that are immediately screwed up by subordinates. But Kvirgic does come in.
I don't think he likes it. I don't think he's ever grown to like that.
No. He does not be resigned to it. That's what gives him the drive to be the dictator of Turkey, not just a querulous guy in a robe somewhere. So January of 1935, Kvirgic sends via the Turkish ambassador in Vienna a pamphlet. And this is the sort of classic crank, I've figured out something about your country, let me explain it to you pamphlet. It's called La Psychologie de quelques éléments de langue Turques, in which he has a theory that the Turkish language makes a great test bed for his theory of the psychological development of language. And he sends it off to the prominent and politically connected Turkish linguist Ahmet Sevret Emre. And he is on the Central Bureau of the TDK, that body that is trying to create Ozturk and de-Arabicize Turkish in general. And Emre sees it and says, this is a crank document. I don't care. And he puts it away. But yep,
correct call,
Kvirgic, nothing loath, and apparently has befriended the Turkish ambassador by being willing to talk Turkish with him, sends another copy of the pamphlet to Ataturk himself. And Ataturk, as you say, something of a linguist himself, a language buff, a conlanger from way back, he'd be speaking Klingon if you were around today, is excited. And he says, why was I not told about this pamphlet? Everyone should read this pamphlet. This pamphlet is amazing. Right. And he has it translated into Turkish.
It shows that a thing that I seem to be wrong about, I wasn't.
Perfect. I wasn't. Yes. And the French original, by the way, has been lost. So the only version we have is this Turkish translation that is kept in Ataturk's personal library.
And apparently it was in poor French.
Yeah. And so we don't know. And I believe you just discussed the fraught nature of translating things into Turkish in 1935. We don't know what the original document may or may not have actually argued, but here's what we have, the current one. And so this proposes, rather than boring old morphology or morphosyntactic analysis, where you study the structure of languages and how they change over time and back it up slowly into Sanskrit usually. No, Freud has fixed everything. Freud must be right. We will use psychology to study language, and that will make sense. And so you study the psychological insights of the word, and you begin by finding the primary vowel sound in the word, because that's the primal sound. You make noises before you start moving your lips and tongue around. Then, once you figured out the sound, you sort of say it to yourself a lot, I'll bet, and then you figure out what concept that sound makes. And then, only then, once you figured out the psychological nature of the sound, do you track its historical sound changes to the extent that you can. Or, the thesis being that a stimulus created a psychological response in people, the early people before language. They vocalized their response with vowels. Those vowels become ritual utterances and then become phonemes, single bodies of linguistic building. So like blah is a phoneme. These phonemes then evolve into words and then languages. And Kvercic believes the clearest example of this process can be seen in Turkish pronouns. Ergo, Turkish must be close to the origin of languages. And this is not unlike when someone in England says, I've figured out where King Arthur was, and you look at their book and it's always, oh, it's next door to where they grew up. That's where it is. So in this case, Kvercic, a hero, does not say that the first language was Slovene or Croat, or even German, it's Turkish, and it's because he knows Turkish and other people in Austria don't, and that makes him special. And so Turkish, therefore, must be close to the origin of language. And then he gets a response from the TDK, because Ataturk says, this is a brilliant pamphlet, send this guy a thank you and a handsome check. And so he writes another one, and this one is Etudes Sumer Turk, and this is building on a different theory by a guy named Hilaire de Barenton. And I say named, that's a name that he takes. He's born something entirely else with no duh in it, but welcome to French scholarship. So he says that all languages developed from Sumerian because it's the earliest language we know. Ergo, all languages must have come from it. A leap without a lot to it, but that's all right. They barely knew what Sumerian was back then. And Kvercic simply says, well, all languages come from Sumerian, but where did Sumerian come from? Perhaps from Central Asia, home of the Turks. And so this proto-Sumerian Central Asian language is what he identifies as proto-Turkish, the first, or probably proto-Turkic, the first and most direct ancestor of Turkish. And so he is met with glad cries by that portion of the TDK that wants to keep their jobs. And so he is brought down to the University of Ankara to be a lecturer in German. And by the end of 1935, he's just a tame scholar. They're paying him to produce studies backing this Turcocentric linguistic viewpoint. And he misses deadlines and they send him mean letters saying, we sent you money. Where's our new study about how great Turkish is? And his wife says, he's very ill. Stop pestering him.
This is the problem when your crank theory gets accepted by somebody, is that you suddenly have to meet deadlines, which wrecks the whole point of being a crank.
So then she writes to Ataturk and says, how come your linguistic foundation is pestering my poor husband, who's in the hospital now, thanks to you? And Ataturk says, why are you pestering him? Send him more money, which is great. So that's the secret. Get Ataturk on your side. And then he says, all right, I'm going to go to Finland. I just need money to go to Finland to study Manchu and Mongol. And they ask, perhaps not unreasonably, what does any of this have to do with Turkish? And he says, oh, I'm studying the fact that they're both Turkic languages. And they say, oh, okay, all is forgiven. Here's your travel money.
Yeah, remember my crank theory? It's that everything is Turkish.
Yeah. So one school of thought, and there's two schools of thought. There's the people at the TDK are going along with this, and Ataturk is going along with this, because the whole point of this is to save face. Since the TDK is supposed to make pure Turkish versions of all their foreign loanwords, and they, for example, have a fake derivation for electricity from the Uyghur word for glittering. So I love that. So they're trying to find out Turkic versions of all the foreign words, the Arabic words, the Persian words, even the Western words. But if all languages are actually Turkic, then we don't have any loanwords and we can stop doing this project that we hate and is embarrassing and makes us look like tools.
Yes, Ataturk no longer has to talk in this horrible lingo that his word nerds came up
exactly.
With. It's much easier to invent a fake etymology for the words people are already using than to make them use different words.
Right. So by November of 1935, the Sun Language Theory, and this is its name now, has appeared in pamphlets and studies from the TDK. The main Turkish newspaper issues pamphlets on it as part of a special series, and I'm sure that flew off the shelves. And in the articles, they credit the whole thing with Ataturk, that our dear leader created this theory in his free time from running the country well. He went to a beach resort and had the structure of ancient Turkish impressed upon him. And they tie it into a different Turcocentric thesis, the Turkish historical thesis, by which the Turks came out of Central Asia, and then they were the Shang dynasty in China, and so they invented China, and then they made Mohenjo-Daro in India, so they invented India, and then they looked and said, who don't we know the language of or where they came from? So they are also the Sumerians, the Hittites, the Minoans. Linear A is Turkish somehow. Etruscans, we don't know what Etruscan comes from. And Elamites. So they've invented all Eurasian civilization as Turkish. Thank you very much, the rest of the world. You're welcome.
But where does the sun come in? This is right. What our listeners want to know. We've mentioned the sun language. Where's the sun part of this?
Well, the sun, Robin, is the first phoneme. Ah! Which is the response to the power and terror of the sun. So primitive man looks up,
sense.
Sees the sun, and goes, ah! And that is the beginning of languages. So sun means not just sun, it means light, it means time, because the sun keeps time, it means warmth, it means cooking, it means all the things, fire, it means all the things, and so ah becomes part of all of those, and language accumulates by accumulating these phonemes, and so not, for example, by adding endings to things like those jerks in Latin and English, or not with just single word creation like Chinese, what they call isolate languages. But Turkish is an agglutinative language, and so proto-language must be agglutinative. Now, this is where calling it the sun language theory of Hermann Fyodor Kvergic is a little unfair, because in the first essay, the word sun never appears, and in the second one, Sumero-Turkic, it only appears once. In all the 300-page essay, the word sun appears once. So the sun may have been something that someone else came up with and sort of inserted. It gets its official debut at the Third Turkish Language Conference in August of 1936, and they have it in Istanbul, and they invite foreign linguists to see what we're doing with Turkish, and the Turkish scholars all praise it. The head of the TDK gives a lengthy speech in which he hints that Ataturk made it up, and everyone then follows that and gives even dumber speeches. And all the foreign scholars, except for Kvergic, kind of ignore it. And they say, would you like to come to a working group, talk about the sun language theory? And they say, oh, we'd love to, but we've got a noun to decline over in another room that you don't know about. And so this is a bit of a snub to sun language theory. They double down on it. It becomes the official curriculum, first in linguistics and Turkology departments in Turkish universities, and then in all Turkish language arts instruction is supposed to start with the origin of the language.
Right. And Ataturk is not given up on being an amateur linguist, because at about this time, he anonymously, in a show of humility, writes a book called Geometry, in which he replaces all Arabic-derived geometry terms with invented purisms. So he is not still totally off the purism bus.
But also, he derives geometry not from the Greek geo, but from the Turk janus. So there we are. He's figured out that he can use sun language theory to keep loanwords that he likes.
Yeah.
But as with all good things, Ataturk's reign comes to an end. He dies in November of 1938, and then everyone's like, well, that was stupid, and never talks of it again, except to blame Kvergic and say, it was this crazy guy from Austria. He made it up. What a nut. I'm glad we have nothing to do with him now.
Yeah, because it turns out that all of the guys at the TDK who've been towing the sun language line while Ataturk was their boss have all just been biding their time. They are still purists. And they actually liked their Ozturk, their chaotic whirl of synonyms. And they feel that the job of replacing Arabic and Persian words with purisms has only just begun. And so they very quickly ditch it for that reason, so they can go back to their project. But meanwhile, I guess Kvergic, he's lost his meal ticket, right?
Yes, but also Austria has been annexed by Hitler underneath him. And he gets out just ahead, emigrates to London with his wife, thanks possibly to a letter of reference from Freud. That's one of the two letters we have in which Freud is clearly writing to someone else saying, yes, Gertrude has helped me a great deal in my work because she runs an English library in Vienna. And I've been it's been very helpful to me. And surely you'd like to help out a buddy of Sigmund Freud's, wouldn't you? And so he gets to London and dies there around 1949. The last thing that we know is he writes another crank letter to another linguist, and that other linguist files it instead of throws it out. But that is the end of Kvergic. He gets out well. I hope he kept some of his TDK money, but probably not. His wife winds up working for The Economist and running their library. So maybe that's what happens. But that's the end of the Kvergic. It not as sordid as it might be, but certainly not being born on the shoulders of linguistic giants into the panoply of world fame. Because like I say, we barely know anything about him. And ironically, the only reason we know anything about him is because scholars interested in this blown up controversy about Turkish have to go and research him to find out the background of it. So if it weren't for his crank theory, he'd be completely forgotten.
And they're also studying the really interesting evolution of Turkish, which evolved much faster under pressure than a lot of languages do, but was still adopted by people. And so in Turkey, the purest word replacers win. And they have two golden eras, the 40s and the 60s. Apparently, they're a little less crazy about it than they were in their first spurt that annoyed Ataturk. And so as a result, they're able to shift the language so that by 1965, 61% of words in common use are Turkish-derived, are homegrown, and that's up from 35% when the TDK was first founded. So they get their way and succeed in changing the way that people speak. And so this brings us to the idea of how to gamify it. Even though it seems like somebody else made a bigger deal about the whole solar thing than Kvergic himself did, that introduces a mystical angle to it that I think makes it something to exploit for a scenario of some sort, and the idea of a government imposing a language or radically changing a language would imply, what are they really trying to do? Like, literally in the real world, what you're doing when you change a language is you're changing the way that people think. You're changing the majority of people who have internal monologues think in words, and the words that they think in, if you change those words, you are gaining power over them. And that reminds us what friend of the podcast, William S. Burroughs, has always said, which is that language is a virus from outer space. And what is more outer space than the sun? So
yeah.
Is it possible, Ken, that all of these phonemes actually literally came from the sun, from some sort of alien force, which is not necessarily our friend?
The notion of using a substrate of language to control people, that goes, you know, that's in The Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson, and it's certainly in Burroughs as well with the Nova language. The existence of a sort of secret Ur language that gives you magic power, that, of course, is what the Armanen are doing in Nazi Germany, even at this very time, and about 20 years before, trying to figure out the earliest runic language so that they can figure out the magic words, the magic songs that will create health and vitality for the people in their race and their country. So you could imagine a Kvergic study, maybe the original French that got suppressed, has a little bit more about how to find the true magic in a word and uncover its magic potential. And maybe you have to do it word by word and then agglutinate your magic word books. And that can be something that secret orders of magicians, not just the Armanen, but other linguistic people are covering up for. Maybe even an obscure linguist at Oxford named Professor Tolkien is involved with his attempting to sort of dig for the elven origins of Celtic and other languages. So we have a real possibility.
Yeah, it turns out all elves are Turkish.
All elves are Turkish. That is well known. Or at least they are from the sun, perhaps, because that's why they're so pale. The notion of this language that's empowering either elven or fairy or alien forces, and that they move through us using the true language that we can't comprehend. I touch on that with my game, The Madness Dossier for GURPS, if you have a copy of that. And certainly it makes a great MacGuffin to find, oh, this is the true grammar, and we can figure out the real word for, I don't know, gun. And then that gives you a magic ability to control, redefine, erase, do whatever you want to anything that is gun, and give the player characters one item that they know the true name of, and that gives them just insane power over. But the trouble is that other people may know other words, and that's where the danger comes in.
And the thing about words, Ken, is that we're out of them for another week. So we're going to have to go rest up a whole other week, accumulate another bunch of words, and then speak them at you, dear listeners, a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrim Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Don the solar mantle of keeping this podcast going alongside such backers as...
Darren Hennessy.
Derek McMullen.
Will Ferguson and Fifi Pyatt.
John W.S. Marvin.
And Manfred Gabriel.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindelaws.bisky.social.
See you next time, and once again, we will talk about stuff.